We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
So today we have come to mourn. And on this particular Tisha B'Av, we don't lack for motivation. We mourn for our dead in Israel, and we mourn for those who have died in our community. But most of all, we mourn for the precariousness that we feel. Or we mourn for the precariousness that we don't feel. We mourn for the lack of urgency about our lives, in which we're constantly aware of the fact that we should be striving in a spiritual way far more than we do. And so we let things slide. In 327 of the guide, Maimonides states that there are two goals for which human beings strive, what he calls the welfare of the body and the welfare of the soul. And although welfare of the soul, which is the spiritual growth that we make, is, in the Rambam's words, indubitably a more noble goal, it's actually welfare of the body that comes first. And by welfare of the body, he means freedom from poverty, freedom from persecution, freedom from physical harassment. That's a prerequisite to spiritual contemplation. If you don't have those things, it's very hard to concentrate on Torah. So no Jew in the year 2002 needs to be reminded of that. Needs to be reminded of the fact of the physical and spiritual devastation all around us. The question I have today, and I have it every day, is how can we cultivate meaning in a world that sometimes seems meaningless? How do we achieve a life of purpose and intensity in a culture of distraction and sordidness and sexual debasement and random violence? Jews now live in crisis, only some of which is a physical security crisis. The deeper problem, as always, is existential. The perpetual issue of what do we live for and how do we overcome the challenges in our path. And I believe that the Rambam, who I'll talk about in the first half of what I have to say, and other thinkers can provide some answers to the problem of a meaningful life. The Rambam lives in the 12th century. And for those who don't know it, the 12th century is called by historians the age of the individual, because there was at that time a new emphasis on self-discovery, on psychological self-examination, and optimism about the capacity of the individual to achieve. And in many ways, that would seem to parallel what we're about now. In our own age, we talk a lot about the self, the primacy of the self, in terms of the way it's often shown in books, film, philosophy, psychology, and so on. But there's a big difference. In the Middle Ages, they did not have our contemporary concept of the individual. What they thought they were discovering when they turned inside was not what we mean by the self. When we speak of the individual, we don't just mean what's inside of us. We mean a particular self that is unique, that is different than anybody else. People talk about finding themselves, and that's what they mean. When the medievals considered the discovery of the inner person, they were talking about one thing only. It was a quest for a very specific part of the self which was already there in each person, which was termed by the Torah the core material of every human being, that is to say, the Tzelem Elohim, the image of God that was inside of him. And it was an image that, in potential, was identical for everybody. So that quest of self-discovery that they had 700 years ago was aimed towards a specific purpose, the development of the self towards God. More specifically, to try and align who I am with where God is. And that Tzelem Elohim, says the Torah, is sort of the spiritual DNA of every human being. So let's contrast that way of thinking about your life, am I in tune with God, with today's world. Partly what modern people struggle with all the time is, who am I? Is there a core self beneath the ebb and flow of my existence? Or is my identity changing all the time, every day, depending on the flux of my life, depending on what's going on with me? What is my identity? How do I define it? Am I what I think? Am I what I do? Am I what I say? Am I what my childhood, especially the first 5 years of my life, made me? Am I where I come from? Am I some odd hybrid of all of these things? These are not just modern questions. These are questions that philosophy, since the age of the Greeks, has been grappling with. And certainly Maimonides grappled with all the time. And they're of great concern to us in an existentially anxious age. Basic questions that Maimonides asks, though not in these words, are, what are the conditions necessary to fashion a meaningful life? And what are the distractions that deflect people away from a life of authentic spiritual and emotional liberation? Now, the truth is that his recipe for a meaningful life would seem to be very harsh at first. He basically feels that your humanness, the very identity you have as a human being, is defined by the intellectual pursuit of God. And by this, he didn't mean some sterile ivory tower concept of the intellect where you just absorb information and ideas. He meant that before you get your mind together, you have to get your morality together. You have to acquire moral piety. You have to master Jewish texts. You have to control and balance your passions. You have to learn math, science, logic, philosophy. You have to be ruthless. Ruthless about removing distraction, any form of trivial distraction from your life. And you have to commit to the process of reason and the awareness of God. Here's what he says early in his career. In his commentary on the Mishnah, he writes, "Man, before he uses his intelligence and acquires knowledge, can be considered as an animal. When a man chases after lusts, and when sensual desires prevail over the conceptual ones, and makes his intelligence subservient to his lusts, so that he receives to be like an animal, which conceives only eating, drinking, and copulation for itself, then the divine capacity, that is intelligence, will not be recognized in him." And that's the theme he repeats in the Mora Nevuchim, in the Guide of the Perplexed, at the end of the guide in the famous chapter 51 of the third book, where he indicates that this kind of person, who's deflected by distraction all the time, quote, has the external shape of a man, but his status is like that of the irrational animals. So, very judgmental. It's not an accident that the guide begins in chapter 1 of book 1 with an analysis of the term Tzelem Elohim. That's where the Rambam's starting premise is, with Tzelem Elohim. That image of God, he tells us, is none other than the human intellect, a capacity in a person that allows them to connect with the intellect which flows from God. And were this another subject, another time, we could talk about the whole Aristotelian system of how this is accomplished, but that's not my purpose here. If you don't use this capacity that you have inside of you, that is God-given, then Maimonides calls you, quote, an animal having the shape and configuration of a man. Worse than this, however, is that this animal in human form has the capacity to wreak havoc and destruction. Here are Maimonides' words, and this of all weeks is a good week to consider them. Quote, such a man applies his capacity for thought and perception which were supposed to prepare him to achieve a perfection that he has not achieved, and uses it for all kinds of machinations entailing evil and engendering all kinds of harm. If you don't make the actualization of God's image inside of you as your top priority, then you end up not simply with mediocrity or what you often hear about, mindless physicality. You end up with the dark side of the spectrum. You end up with evil. Now, I was very struck by this passage of the guy, and I've spoken about this before, when I read a book a few years ago by Ron Rosenbaum called Explaining Hitler, in which the author examines those historians who in the past 50 years have tried to explain how a person could have arisen and what constituted that kind of evil. Now, I want to tell you that the most striking part of this book is actually the cover. The cover photo is a picture of Hitler at the age of probably 2. It is a sweet, cherubic face. And the photograph is a deliberate attempt to force the reader to encounter what seems like an absolutely staggering transition between this innocent child on the one hand, this Tselem Elohim on the one hand, to the monster of adulthood. How could he have become Adolf Hitler? And so on. And I was reminded of again, tragically, this week, with the picture in the paper of the perpetrator of this week's horrible murder. Same question. That is why it is crucial for the Rambam that you do not have intellect without moral guidance, because intellect without moral guidance is not just sterile and empty, it's dangerous. Very, very dangerous. And that's why in Judaism, no matter how much moderns complain, no one is exempt from the yoke of mitzvot. No one. Geniuses are not exempt. Doesn't matter how smart you are, doesn't matter how wealthy you are, how privileged you are, how much status you have, it's all completely irrelevant. The moral life is sui generis. It's a life unto itself. There is no necessary equation in Maimonides between intelligence and morality. Only when moral piety becomes firmly established in a person can one begin to live. Now, it is true that the Rambam considers intellectual perfection as the domain of very few people. Even a person who achieves just a small bit of true selfhood is relatively rare. Why? Because of the enormous pull of distraction in human life. Because of cultures much like the one we live in right now, which exhibit, in my opinion, a marked hostility towards the intellect and celebrate, for what I can see from my vantage point, basically gossip and temporal fads, whatever passes. We live in a remarkably anti-intellectual culture. Intellect is almost seen as a dirty word. It's viewed very suspiciously. It's seen as the domain kind of philosophy students who are out of touch with the world. And in its most benign form, we accept it. When it's attached to science, we'll allow scientists to be smart because they do practical stuff, quote unquote. They achieve medical breakthroughs and so on. The world of ideas basically loses out in the West to the cult of personality. That's what we're really interested in, is the cult of personality. And Maimonides, where he was living, was acutely aware of the tragic implications of this. For him, distraction and truth are really at the opposite ends of the life spectrum. So I want to talk about distraction for a few minutes in that regard. The American philosopher Robert Nozick once created a kind of thought experiment which he called the experience machine. In Nozick's fantasy, a person could pre-program their life before you entered a kind of tank or machine, and you would have whatever you always wanted. Everybody can stop and reflect for a moment. What is your deepest fantasy? You could plug it in, and that would be your life. Whatever you wanted. You want adventure, you want romance, you want travel, you've got it. And it would feel to you as if it was totally real. That is to say, you would not even be aware of the fact that you were living a complete illusion inside of a tank. Put it another way, you wouldn't just be watching the movie, you'd think you were actually in the movie. Now, Nozick's comment on this process is to ask whether the only thing that's important in your life is how something feels, regardless of whether it's an illusion or whether it's true. Because sometimes when I look around me, I sort of feel like that's what really counts. It's just whether it feels good. But Judaism doesn't believe in feeling over truth. And Robert Nozick argues that a human being is about more than feelings, that the search for a meaningful life is not just feeling good. The number one thing that you get on a man on the street poll in the West is that a meaningful life is one that makes me happy. There's an automatic equation between feeling good and the search for meaning. And Nozick's analysis is meant to deconstruct that. It's meant to say, if you really, it's just about feeling good, here, I can make you feel good. I can make you feel better than you ever have. Do you think that that's a life? Now, I personally feel this is much more than just some kind of amusing philosophical diversion. I think the issue of whether a person prefers pleasant illusion to the often much more complicated and inevitably more painful fate of real life is one that comes up again and again for all of us. For example, and I've asked this question on a yearly basis to my grade 12 students at CHAT, if you could have, they have to speculate forwards, if you could have a marriage where your spouse continuously cheats on you, but you don't know, and you're very happy otherwise, would you wish that illusion to carry on forever? Or would you want to know the painful truth even if it shatters your life? That question, that very question, actually faces the narrator of one of the great novels of the 20th century, which is Ford Madox Ford's novel, The Good Soldier, which was published in 1915. The narrator of The Good Soldier is telling his tale backwards. It's all happened already. He's trying to understand the events that have occurred to him. And what's occurred to him is that he has never had sexual relations with his wife because she told him on their wedding night that her doctor had forbade it because she has a heart condition. But he finds 9 years later that she has had an ongoing affair with his best friend, the good soldier of the novel's title. His world blows up. His quote-unquote happiness, although, albeit it's an illusion, that he has enjoyed for years, comes crashing down. He's in a great deal of pain. And here is his question. Quote, if for 9 years I have possessed a goodly apple that is rotten at the core and discovered its rottenness only in 9 years and 6 months, less 4 days. Isn't it true to say that for 9 years I possessed a goodly apple? I like that question. If we live a life of distracted illusion, but we're happy within that lie, does it matter? Isn't that a good life? See, I suspect actually that almost no one wants to be cheated on and not know about it. Even if ignorance is bliss, even despite the obvious feelings of loss and fragmentation that would ensue, despite our all-too-easy capacity for illusion and our claims that we just want to be happy at all costs, there's still, within each of us a strangely powerful instinct for the truth. Given that we want the truth on some level very deeply, the threat caused by distraction to the achievement of a life of purpose is considerable, and for the Rambam, the solutions to this problem are very complicated. But as sympathetic as he may be to the difficulties in being a real person, he also took a very grown-up view of individual responsibility, i.e., you can't just blame the culture around you for your lack of focus. You can't blame your parents, can't blame your friends, can't blame your spouse, can't blame your kids. Indeed, in the final chapters of the guide, where things reach a kind of crescendo rarely seen in the history of Jewish texts, Maimonides stresses that a person's life will ultimately go the direction that they want to take it. He says, you have the choice. If you wish to fortify your bond with God, you can do so. And if you wish to make it weaker until you can cut it, you can also do that. It's crucial to recognize, by the way, that this kind of lack of intense relationship with God is not just the domain of secular people. The Rambam actually has very strong words for those in religious communities who externally carry out mitzvot but are clearly distracted in their heads. He says, if you pray merely by moving your lips and at the same time you're thinking about buying and selling, or if you read the Torah with your tongue while your heart is set upon the building of your house, then you should not think you have achieved your end. Now, the Rambam never visited Toronto, but I find his examples of wealth and real estate somewhat contemporary. Maimonides sees the goal of Torah as the creation of individuals, which is fascinating when you consider the criticism that Judaism always encounters, which is that it's slavish and it's robotic and it's mechanical and it's a law-driven religion. And the Rambam actually would see this as a radical misunderstanding of the Torah's ability to further a meaningful life, the ends of the self. He sees self-perfection as the goal of all mitzvot. And in fact, much of the guide is devoted to a discussion of how paganism infected the world with idolatrous thinking and how the traces of this idolatry remain with us. Those who have read the guide will remember that he talks a lot about certain mitzvot, which on the face of it don't seem to make a lot of sense in the Torah, really being a way of battering against idolatry. But what's idolatry for the Rambam? It's conformity. And the Torah is constantly challenging the individual to rise above conformity and to thoughtless devotion to material things and to achieve selfhood. What is the pagan mind? It is the antithesis of individualism. The pagans thrived on social custom and mindless groupthink. The foremost historian of the pagans, the famous religious theorist Mircea Eliade, notes that in pagan society, reality is achieved through imitation. That's an amazing idea. I sometimes get that in high school, when I'll tell somebody something that happened in real life, and my students will say, oh yeah, I saw that on television. Eliade characterizes primitive man as a person who, quote, sees himself as real only to the extent that he ceases to be himself and is satisfied with imitating and repeating the gestures of other people. In other words, he sees himself as real, as only truly himself, only and precisely when he ceases to be himself. So for the Rambam, Torah is the liberation from that. It's the opportunity to attach to God and get out of the pagan mind. So Torah stresses the solution to a profound paradox, which is that only in relationship with an other, family, friends, ultimately with God, does genuinely meaningful selfhood emerge? To explain the use of God as the other, I want to draw upon a description which is taken from the child psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. Winnicott says that the true self does not become a living reality except as a result of the mother's repeated success in meeting the infant's spontaneous gesture. Winnicott had a very famous phrase. He used to say, there's no such thing as a baby. In other words, there's no such thing as just an isolated human being in a vacuum. All people begin and develop based on, contingent on, their relationship with another. And the first other is the mother. And when the baby contacts mom's face, and mom's face reflects back to the baby in a successful manner, selfhood emerges. What about the mother who doesn't or cannot reflect her child, whose face instead reflects only her moods and her needs? What does the baby see in such instances? A little baby looks for his or her mother, and the mother is anxious, the mother is depressed, the mother is preoccupied. The mother reflects back herself. So the baby does not find itself in the mother. And when there is a regular failure to find yourself in the other, Winnicott says they look and they don't see themselves. They can't find themselves. And if a continuously non-reflecting face meets the child, then the child begins to adapt its gestures to accommodate what is presented. That's what you're giving me. I guess I'm going to have to adapt to that. That, says Winnicott, is the beginning of the false self. A very poignant picture that Winnicott writes about, of a baby striving to find itself in the mother's face, and it's worth comparing to the other two pictures that I've laid before you of Eliade's vision of the pagan and of Maimonides' concept of seeking the image of God. The pagan never separates his sense of self from the cultural myth that surrounds him. That's why we live in a profoundly pagan society. Profoundly pagan, the West. We don't want to bow down to idols of wood and stone, but that's the exact definition of what we do in our culture. We find our bearings from the myths that surround us. Winnicott's baby learns to form a self from the nurturing, mirroring gaze of mom. And for Maimonides, the deepest thing of all is that you find yourself by looking at the image of God that you've got inside, mirroring your true self to you. You want to know who you really are, says the Rambam? Find the Tzelem Elohim inside of you, and that's your starting point. Of course, it's obvious to all of us that there's a crucial distinction in each of these pictures, because for Winnicott, you find yourself in the actual tangible physical presence of the mother's face. And part of our problem is that how do we know that God is within us if there's no tangible or external trace of God's presence? Now, it's true that the medievals thought of nature as God's book, an idea which the Rambam agrees with, but from a common sense perspective, we don't see God, we don't hear God. God cannot even in the remotest fashion be directly discovered in those ways. And even Jewish tradition, which speaks of prophecy, which speaks of revelation, and speaks of nature as a sign of God, also emphasizes that God doesn't leave any traces of himself. The rabbis stress, in fact, Chazal say that even when God was performing wonders and miracles, he left no evidence of his presence. In Psalm 77, we read, your path is in the sea, your trails are in the many waters, but your footprints cannot be known. Even when splitting the Red Sea, the Midrash tells us that the sea quickly returned to its original form, leaving no trace of God's intervention. So God is hard to find. That's part of the problem. That's the paradox. We're saying that Jewish selfhood stems from the image of God, but God is hard to trace. There was a medieval Rabbi Yosef Ibn Abitur who writes in the 11th century that the idea of a trace comes as a result of an object which resists something standing on it. Right? An example would be you're tracking along in mud or in snow. So the trace of your presence is recorded by the interaction between the thing and that which it comes in contact with. You need resistance to create a trace of something. But God doesn't contact humans in that way. There's no resistance. There's no trace. Isaac Newton said the same thing. He said, celestial bodies find no resistance from the omnipresence of God. I'm not sure if he was trying to be humorous. Newton wasn't renowned for his humor. That is a big problem for faith. It's a big problem for the argument I'm presenting here. I'm trying to say very simply that from a Jewish point of view, the beginning and end of a meaningful life is the desire to be in continuous contact with God, and yet we're saying that that contact, paradoxically, is almost impossible. And yet, that is what we need. More than anything else at this point in our lives is a solid sense of faith in ourselves and our futures, grounded in our belief in God. The problem of life's meaning for religious Jews, I would argue actually for every human being, is directly related to feeling that God is there, that God hears me, that God is available for my concerns. Why don't we feel God today? On some level, we have to understand that that question, that problem is not new. It goes back to the very founding of humanity in the Garden of Eden. The Hasidic master, brilliant Hasidic master of Tzedek HaKohen, in his comments on Bereishit, teaches that the first sin of human beings was Adam and Eve eating without what he calls proper kavanah. Says an amazing thing. He says the tree of knowledge was not a tree, was not a food, was not a thing at all. Reb Tzedek HaKohen says it was a way of eating. It was an attitude to what we have and what our purpose is in using what we have. Susie Schneider, in her book, Eating as Tikkun, calls this the problem of unholy eating. She writes, all neuroses, personality imbalances, and existential dissatisfactions, teaches the Torah, have their root in this sin of unholy eating. Every person has an eating disorder. For eating is a much broader activity than simply taking food into your mouth. She writes, eating is an archetype. It is the experience of lack. The taking inside of yourself of something from outside yourself to fill your lack. Something that was not you becomes a piece of you. Literal eating, material acquisition, sexuality, honor seeking, addiction to power, praise, drugs, or even attention. These are all forms of eating. They start with an experience of lack, and in an effort to assuage that lack, you pull something from the outside in. If you were to ask me the problem in the contemporary Jewish experience, I would not change one word of what Susan Schneider writes. I see it in the teenagers and college students and adults I teach. I see it in from people, and I see it in non-observant people. I see it in men, and I see it in women. I see it in others, and I see it in myself. The painful sense of lack, often pertaining to childhood, which needs to be filled up. And some of the ways that we fill up these empty spaces have to do with idle or mindless distraction, and some of the ways are even more self-destructive. And in Judaism, the way you fill up your empty space is to fill it with God. And therein lies the catch-22. For many people, the ability to feel loved by God is contingent on already feeling filled up. I can let God in if I feel good enough to let God in. And yet Judaism says that a meaningful life is only attained after you can feel connected to God. So if God is the necessary prerequisite for ultimate meaning in a person's existence, and yet God is hard to find, what options are left for the believing Jew who wants to take his or her spiritual life further, as far as it can go? And I think the first step is recognizing in a profound way that all interlock, whatever you're missing inside, wherever it feels empty or vulnerable, can never be replenished from outside, only from within. A very painful but very important step. No person, no thing, no object, no drug, no clothing, no fantasy, no house, no worldly status or approval, nothing from the outside can repair an inner lack. Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his comments on this week's Parsha, actually, in Veskana, discusses the difference between change that comes from outside and change that comes from inside. The Rebbe begins by discussing the difference between the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, and he says that the former, the Mishkan, was holy, but its sanctity lasted only as long as the Shekhinah rested there. When the Mishkan moved, its former resting place stopped being holy ground. And the Rambam writes at the end of Hilchot Beit HaBechira that the sanctity of the Beit HaMikdash was vested in the physical material in which it was built, and even after its destruction, the ground was and is still sacred. And the Rebbe parallels this to the difference between the two ways that the world and its beings are transformed. He says, we may be changed by a light that comes from above, similar to the way a pupil is changed by a teacher. The pupil may come to understand what he's been taught, but it's still a reflection of his teacher. He's like the moon. He sheds the light that comes to him from somewhere else. On the other hand, we can be changed by a light that comes from inside. When a person, for example, returns to God, does tshuva in any way, has an ounce, a second of genuine regret for a life not lived in the way it should be lived, he doesn't do that, says the Rebbe, because of any revelation from above, from any great vision from God. On the contrary, he's far from visions of God. He does so because of a prompting from inside. Such a person, he says, is like the moon of the world to come, which no longer reflects light, but burns from inside. I think that there are things that we can do as individuals. We hear about these things every year. They become like a kind of rote litany, Torah study, greater intensity in tefillah, more acts of chesed, less concentration on the material. I think that's all true. I also believe that generating this inner light paradoxically can't be accomplished entirely by the individual. It has to be augmented by the kinds of communities that we create to organize and elevate our Torah lives. And in the remainder of the time left to me, I want to speak about our community. I will speak personally. I need a community of faith. Faith can't exist in a vacuum. It requires the support of other people. It's contingent on people sharing a similar worldview, a similar sensibility. As far as I can see, that view is gone. It's certainly gone in secular culture. It seems to me pretty far gone, even in Orthodox culture. What we have is what Stephen Carter calls the culture of disbelief. This seems very odd, right? Aren't we believers? Don't we have faith? Don't we keep Shabbos and Kashrut and all the rest? But here I think we need to be very honest with ourselves. I don't think I can overemphasize the degree to which contemporary Judaism seems to shy away from discussing, ironically, our primary raison d'etre, which is the search for God and the enormous challenge to faith and its moral consequences in the face of modern Western secularism. One of the major problems that I see with Jewish religious leadership of all kinds at present is that it has a tendency either, on the one hand, to proclaim simplistic truths about God in a world of great complexity, or on the other hand, because it flinches from the idea of selling the hard line of God, truth, Sinai. So it begins to sell, market religion as a medium for self-growth, very modern word, or a place to learn values, distinctly non-Jewish word, which makes it no more and no less than a good course of psychotherapy or humanitarian activity. In truth, what I see in our community is that we all look over our religious shoulders, and many of us look over our right shoulder, at what does the next guy do, instead of taking personal responsibility. The Midrash in the Mechilta records a very well-known and interesting machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda regarding the entrance of the Jewish people into the Yamsuf, the Red Sea. Many of us are familiar with the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, that when they stood by the sea, each person resisted being the first one to go in until Nachshon ben Aminadav jumped up first and fell into the waves. The opinion of Rabbi Meir is the reverse, interesting opinion. He claims that when the tribes stood by the sea, one tribe said, I'll go into the sea first, and another one said, no, I'll go down to where the sea is first. And then finally, the tribe of Binyamin jumps in first, and they're rewarded with a Shekhinah, a very nice midrash. Nechama Leibowitz once commented on this midrash. She said the attitude of the tribes in Rabbi Meir's opinion is very strange. It only makes sense if there's like sort of a narrow doorway going down to the sea in front of which you have to sort of jostle for position. But if everybody has room to go into the sea, then why is everybody acting like they're being opposed by the next fellow? Just jump in. What's the problem? It's not like anyone's blocking you. Could it be that that's what describes us? Yelling that we all want to be the first to jump into the sea of faith, and yet oddly acting as if there were restraints upon us. Why not just jump? So I believe that faith is not just a personal revelation, but a trust in a community of faith. If we see role models around us, people of faith who model religious honesty, personal integrity, who can inspire with their thoughts and their deeds, and their ability to absorb our question and our doubt with a non-judgmental and loving attitude, then we trust in the community of faith. And if not, we remain on the edge of the sea, supposedly clamoring to enter the water, but actually terrified of the heart of the religious life. Now, I'd like to speak now with respect to the modern Orthodox community and also as a Jewish educator. I'd like to share with you part of a letter which I wrote in the fall of 1999 to a colleague of mine who's a wonderful teacher. The subject was one of his pet peeves, passion within modern Orthodox education. I'll leave his name out. Dear, you raise the issue of whether passion can be delivered to modern Orthodox youth and whether a culture of moderation and tolerance, such as in theory modern Orthodoxy purports to be, is capable of transmitting intensity. I say in theory because while moderation and tolerance are admirable words, at least in terms of Western secular liberalism, I'm not persuaded that they are A, entirely supported by Jewish tradition, and B, I'm often suspicious that what we call modern Orthodoxy's tolerance is simply a code word for a complete surrender. Complete surrender to the prevailing zeitgeist. We in Orthodoxy, especially modern Orthodoxy, what do we believe in? What actual philosophy of existence? You write, seemingly in praise of modern orthodoxy, of an interfacing with modernity, a contending with elements and processes in the world around us. You must be kidding. I rarely see the modern Orthodox community grapple or even raise issues of real interface, which then lead to genuine dilemmas of whether and in what way Judaism possesses truth, even or especially in the magazines that seem to speak for it. I find it remarkably disingenuous when the modern Orthodox world attacks the Haredim for their narrowness and lack of intellectual honesty, as though we have courageously galloped to the front of the battle lines surrounding the encounter, bracket, tension, no matter how you rationalize it, tension between Judaism and archaeology, evolution, semiotics, feminism, psychology, art, philosophy, or for that matter, the Chicago Bulls. The French Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas puts it perfectly when he wonders how revelation in its literal sense can be understood by modern Jews who are troubled by the end of metaphysics, by the triumphs of psychoanalysis, sociology, political economy, by someone who has learned from linguistics that meaning is produced by signs without signifies, without referential points, and who, confronted with all of these intellectual splendors, sometimes wonders if he's not witnessing a funeral celebration held in honor of a dead god. In simpler terms than Levinas, modernity has assaulted truth, has exploded the meaning of language, has shredded the grip of authority, laid faith to waste. Every day, and this I can say with authority, every day, I see teenagers acting out thoroughly unwittingly the words of Levinas, unable to breathe in a pure faith because they're so tossed and turned by how the post-Kantian universe has turned language and love and truth inside out. Students have been so thoroughly molded by Hollywood and Wall Street as to be utterly unself-conscious about their own moral thinking. And what do we in the modern Orthodox world have to say about this assault on truth and on the increasing difficulty for a sophisticated and well-meaning modern person to absorb the traditional take on Torah? What do we have to say about the destruction of heroism, of role models? For the most part, a vast, unconfessed, and hence unbroken silence. I, for one, am unclear what all of this synthesis really means in any event, because what it doesn't mean is some combination of Kant and the Kutzker, Darwin and Dafyomi, as though the problem with modern Orthodox kids is their potential corruptibility or salvation at the hands of Western philosophy's finest. Would toward it were. Halavai. No 17-year-old, or 27-year-old, or 57-year-old, for that matter, cares a hoot about Kant, because for the most part, they don't relish ideas. My 17-year-olds are ingesting Nirvana and Alanis Morissette through their Walkmans, not Hegel's phenomenology. The bottom line is that we, as a Jewish people, in Jewish communities, in shuls, in yeshivot, have failed, simply failed, to communicate on matters of intellectual substance, and we shy away from dealing with the enigma of Torah. Now, I'm going to tell you a true story, still part of my letter. I once had a student, a good, sincere, modern Orthodox boy, about 16 years old, comes to me, complains to me that his rabbi, a good, sincere, modern Orthodox man of about 50, talks of absolutely nothing that he cares about at all, be it sexual integrity, romantic unreadiness, be it relating to a God who seems silent and absent, if not worse at times, be it confronting his own inner turmoil about a whole host of emotional issues, be it the question of what is real and how to gain access to it, be it autonomy versus his own autonomy versus authority. His rabbi, he tells me, is smart. His rabbi interfaces, to use my colleague's term, interfaces all the time with things modern, can tell a good joke, trade baseball stats, offer an analysis of Mac versus IBM, is computer literate. He just has nothing to say of any intensity or real honesty about religious doubt and worldly confusion. So is our focus in teaching kids, creating meaningful lives for Jewish children, to tell teenagers, my populace, to buy into the package, God belief, unerring revelation at Sinai, oral laws, will of God, divinely sanctioned halakhic authority of sages, and so on? Or do we soft sell it for fear that it won't be bought and avoid entirely the whole notion of truth? And hard sell the notion of things like values of Jewish living, family life, community. Problems both ways. Now you see what it's like to be a teacher. Problems both ways. You see, if you use the former, the package, are we willing, really willing, in our community to face up to the enormous problems with the package? Are we really willing, with all due respect to Bible codes, creationist science, and the like? I personally often find the notion that divinity imbues, say, the 36th chapter of Reshit, Esav's genealogy, a hard swallow. I don't deny that it comes from God. It just seems utterly strange to me. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Of course, all of this talk has become completely verboten in Jewish communities. We've lost entirely, from what I can see, the ability to cultivate, in the Buddhist scholar Stephen Batchelor's words, the faith to doubt. The faith to doubt. And if we imply to the kids that we're not fully sure that the Jewish life we lead really is totally 100% sourced in God dictating to Moshe, but rather we follow halakha because of, oh, it's meaningful, it promotes good values, it gives us structure in our lives, then what we're really promoting is expedience and functionality over truth. It's like a Jewish version of Pascal, the wager. Put your money on Torah, we'll find out the real truth in heaven. And for now, religion is a good, safe, healthy path to follow. That leaves me very queasy. It makes me feel like a fraud, actually. Somewhere in there are issues that have to be raised, that have to be addressed, and not in one-day seminars showing that the word Mashiach is encoded through Scripture every 24 letters. And if, conversely, we present a united, hardline front about Torah's infallibility, and we say that it's all perfectly fitting, then you have to face the skeptical eye of our ironically modern Orthodox students who cast a wary glance at the notion of truth. So what do we have to say to them? What do we have to say to ourselves about belief in God, trust that God connects to human beings in a tangible way, that God would contract himself twice, to use the Kabbalistic terminology, not merely to leave space for the world, but also to specifically address the Jewish people and nobody else among the plethora of pagans. And that such revelation would happen one time only to a desert tribe. And that such communication as was made to this desert tribe will have to suffice for the rest of us for all time, despite the anachronistic quality of reading Torah portions containing references to slavery, concubines, animal sacrifice, leprosy, mass destruction of pagan populaces, agrarian rules, levirate marriage, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. And that's just the first level of difficulty. Is it, in your words, quote, the very willingness to embrace challenge which characterizes modern orthodoxy, unquote, or is it something quite a bit more parve, which epitomizes our community at present? What I do know is that my students want a religion which directly addresses their emotional and spiritual lack. Otherwise, it's back to the Chicago Bulls in a flash. Because for all of modern orthodoxy's intellectual heavyweights, my students will take Shlomo Carlebach any day, with or without modernity. Yours truly. That's about a third of the letter. Now, I look back on this now, 3 years later, and I recognize that a couple of items clearly need updating. And they are, number one, the Bulls are no longer the team of choice. Number two, although Nirvana hangs in there with the cult crowd, certain bands are more au courant. Other than that, I wouldn't change a word. I can't see that the basic parameters of the dilemma have shifted that much. And indeed, the problem in conveying meaning in Jewish education with issues like passion and truth and honesty and relevance only grows more poignant the deeper into postmodernity we go. So what do you do about it? Let's say you're teaching your kids. Well, I'll talk about how it seems like to me, teaching your kids. There are different tacks you can take. Certain teachers will simply deny that there is a problem, pass it off to the tragic influence of modern secularism on true faith, and dismiss, whoosh, in one fell swoop, archaeology and textual criticism and philosophy and historiography and feminism and modern science, not to mention the Holocaust, and just plain intuition as snares to be sidestepped, a Yetzer Hara, as surely as ancient idolatry. Other people, other teachers, will diligently try to track down every single one of these challenges and offer rebuttals and counter critiques, leading to the interesting appearance of what I call Renaissance rabbis, equally well-versed in Gemara and science, ethics, and glorious Steinem, with the admonishment, know what to answer the Apikoros, never far from sight. Still others will neither deny nor dismiss. They'll just focus on Judaism's beauty, its mystical power, and they'll intimate that there's an extra-rational dimension to religion that can't be encompassed or understood by an assault from reason. I'm actually sympathetic to all three approaches. And each of them can provide solace for some kids, for particular students, for their own idiosyncratic confusions. But you want to know the truth? More and more I'm persuaded that one important method of negotiating the tug of war between this mantra of autonomy and the claim of Torah tradition lies in the teacher, the parent, the rabbi, all of us, our ability to model our own lives, our own real life struggles, some of which I've tried to do here, of faith and doubt and fidelity and anguish, perplexity. There's a lot out there. There's a whole panoply of entertainment that's pulling at our children. And it becomes incumbent on us to step out from behind the text, to step out from behind the halakha, to step out from behind the piety and the platitudes, and disclose in real terms to other people what my own life experience can reveal about the complexity of Torah and of existence. Because the time for piety is over. The time for fake platitudes is done. We need to share with each other what we believe and what troubles us. We need to talk about God far more openly than we do and discuss the hypocrisies that we hold in our communities with respect to inclusiveness, with respect to wealth, with respect to differences of opinion. We have to acknowledge to ourselves that there is much we don't know about other people, that we cannot judge them, and that just because we don't agree with something does not make it untrue. And just as a side point, since this is the day, and the Gemara points out in Yuma, on Tet Amud Beit, that Sinat Chinam destroyed the Second Temple, it's worth understanding that if you look across Shas, Sina is not what we think it is. We tend to take those words and think that these people were raging at each other in anger and hostility, but if you look in other places in the Gemara, it's actually considerably lower key what constitutes Sina. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin basically says that if you don't talk to somebody for 3 days, out of Ava, out of enmity, because of bad feeling, you're sone. You're sone. Snia, Sin'ah is not confronting our issues. It's not speaking to the other guy. It's contracting coldly. It's the cold silence, not just the fiery argument. It's standing by while injustice happens. That is Sina for the Gemara. You don't have to get into a knockdown, drag-em-out argument to be a Sona. He says light has no value in itself. Its usefulness depends on the existence of other things which are illuminated by it, or which benefit from it. Why was light created when nothing else existed? Further to this, the Zohar points out in Hebrew that the words light, or, and secrets, raz, have the same numerical equivalent, gematria of 207. Light is a revealed thing. A secret is a hidden thing. What's the connection? The Rebbe reviews certain answers made by Chazal, and he suggests that there was something for light to shine on, and that thing was darkness. If, says the Rebbe, light is the purpose of every created thing, it follows that it must also be the purpose of darkness. That is, that the purpose of darkness is to be transformed into light. That's why it's there. It's not there to be avoided. It's not there to be shut up. It's not there to be circumvented or shunned or be embarrassed by. It's there to be illuminated. The world was made so that Israel, through Torah, should turn into an everlasting light of God's revealed presence. As the Pasuk tells us in Yeshaya, the sun will no more be your light by day, nor for brightness will the moon give you light, but the Lord shall be for you a light everlasting. May Hashem grant us light in the years to come, and the redemption which we all so desperately need.
May we be married to meet and celebrate next year in Jerusalem on the 9th of Av.